You're listening to Film Week on KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle, reminding you, when you can't listen to the program live on KPCC, it's available as a podcast, wherever you get your podcasts. We heard a little bit from our critics earlier about how much they enjoyed the film Nomadland from writer-director Chloe Zhao. It follows a woman after the economic collapse of a company town in rural Nevada. And it's based on a book from journalist Jessica Bruder. Our John Horn talked with Bruder about the adaptation of her book.
I want to go back to the first contact you had from somebody who was thinking about adapting your book into a narrative film, a fact-based but narrative film. What was your immediate reaction to that idea?
So I was out in my van on book tour in Los Angeles when I heard from my literary agent that she'd gotten a call from UTA, which at the time I hadn't even heard of, but apparently an agent at UTA had read Nomadland and wanted to shop it around for possible adaptation into a TV series or a film. And I thought that sounded really cool, but by the same token, I took it with a very large grain, maybe a rock of salt, because I have a lot of friends who have had their material adapted and only to hear crickets after it. So I tried to curb my enthusiasm. I put myself on a diet of low expectations, but, you know, still felt excited. Didn't know what would happen next.
So it does move along, and it obviously becomes a film. That's why we're having this conversation. And one of the decisions that was made by both Chloe Zhao and Frances McDormand as producer was to involve the real nomads in the telling of the story. Now, you have spent years with these people, and what they're going to do is, you know, slightly fictionalize some of their lives. But that idea of using the nomads, ask the nomads, did you feel good about it? Did you have mixed feelings? What was your reaction to that concept?
I felt predominantly good about it. I had seen Chloe's film, The Rider, which I thought was fantastic and used non-actors. At the same time, part of me was anxious. I won't lie. These are people that I'd spent so much time and care with. And you know, as a consulting producer, it was my job to make all these introductions. And while I thought everything would go well, it felt like a fair amount of pressure just introducing these people who I'd come to care about to a different world of story and representation. And, you know, if that all went pear-shaped, I would have felt like it was on me.
There are so many things in your book about how we have preconceived ideas of the way things work, the way people become homeless or houseless, as nomads like to call themselves. I want to start by quoting an organization near and dear to me, and that is NPR. You start a chapter, chapter 8 in your book, saying one segment on NPR's All Things Considered began with a correspondent's voiceover. Santa, of course, needs elves to make sure he delivers his presents on time. Amazon.com needs work campers. The life of a work camper is not quite as jovial as that NPR piece would suggest. So when you were out there as a reporter and then as a writer, how much are you challenging your own ideas about how things get made? Like, how does an Amazon box get on your doorstop with the things in it inside? Did you have any idea of what the, you know, how the sausage was actually made?
I had done a lot of interviews that I wanted to ground truth by actually going in. And what did strike me, what I was hearing did suggest a really strong contrast between how these jobs were being advertised and what people actually experienced. Even with the campground hosting jobs, they were promoted as get paid to go camping. You know, I know two people who broke ribs on those jobs.
Or get paid to clean pit toilets.
Pretty much. Yeah, that's not a very good hook, I guess. But, you know, at the sugar beet harvest, which I also spent a week working at, it was advertised as the unbeatable experience. And, you know, you're on your feet for 12 hours at a time on a concrete floor, in some cases getting hit with beets as they're going up a conveyor belt and getting piled in these massive piles. It's cold, it's dirty. It was a lot of things, but I wouldn't call it an unbeatable experience. So the contrasts were there.
When I saw the film and saw that there was actual filming in what looked like an Amazon warehouse, I said to myself, either Frances McDormand is good friends with Jeff Bezos, or you have built as a set the biggest warehouse I've ever seen. The book, and I will say the film, have a slightly different take on Amazon. Amazon comes off, I would say, a little bit worse, if not much worse, in your book. But I'm curious, when you heard that they were able to film inside Amazon, what was your reaction?
Honestly? I did wonder how they'd pulled it off. I didn't know. I took a wait-and-see approach, but yeah, I was definitely surprised. But again, I'd imagine that's something that would be pretty hard to recreate.
I want to ask you about some of the motivations behind your work in telling the story of Nomadland. How did you start thinking about the idea, and how did you end up reporting it? Because not only is the book filled with a lot of anecdotal observations about the real nomads, but it's also filled with a tremendous amount of research about retirement and Social Security and housing and companies that look after you and companies that don't. What was your entry point into the story, and what kind of sparked your interest in it?
I, like many journalists, do a heck of a lot of reading. And gosh, I'd come across one article that brought up very briefly Amazon's Camper Force program. There was somebody who told a reporter, I work here, I live in an RV, but I can't afford to retire. There's a whole program for people like us. And that really piqued my curiosity. I couldn't stop thinking about it. I ended up doing a bunch of research and seeing that the Amazon jobs were out there, a program called Camper Force, along with hundreds, possibly even thousands of other jobs on this circuit around the country that were seasonal jobs, largely targeted to older workers. And that made me wonder what's going on here. So I started out in a tent, actually. I was reporting from the Sonoran Desert outside of Quartzsite for Harper's story. And when that story was done, I still had so many questions. So I was quite lucky that I got to hit the road in a van and expand it into a book.
And the way we look at the poor, I think, is really well represented in something that seems incredibly trivial, but it's a corner square on the Monopoly game board. What's the square and what is its story?
Yeah, so the square originally said poorhouse, and it was a reference to the poorhouse, which existed in America. It was imported from Great Britain, and it was a dismal place. Basically, if you were not able to move in with your kids, if you had any, and you were too old to work, this was where you ended up. It was a place of last resort. These buildings were old and dilapidated. They were miserable and just a horrible place to be.
No, it's like Charles Dickens times five.
Times 10. Absolutely. Dickensian buildings. So later on, the place became free parking, which is kind of funny given the context of what I was writing about, the idea that the last free place in America is a parking spot. But in fact, that's not even always true anymore, because we have so many laws that are criminalizing sleeping in your vehicles. So, you know, maybe the spot will evolve again. We'll see.
One of the things that you talk about in your book that I think is reflected in kind of the mindset of the nomads is that one of the most important things to have as a citizen or as a person, as a voter, however you want to identify that, is a mailing address. And these nomads generally don't, because they're moving from place to place. What is tied to a mailing address that is so important for somebody's well-being and quality of life?
Some of these are very tangible things. Your address is something you need for a driver's license. Your address is connected to your insurance. It's connected to your taxes or any benefits you might be receiving. It allows you to register to vote. So you really can't avoid having an address. It's basically a quick way to excommunicate yourself from participating in, you know, the work of actually just living in America. So many people I met have fake addresses, whether they're the addresses of friends or family or the address of a mail forwarding service, which receives all your mail and then forwards it wherever you'd like it to go.
When we come back, we'll hear more from our John Horn in conversation with writer Jessica Bruder. Her book, Nomadland, inspired the film adaptation starring Frances McDormand. It's KPCC and Film Week. We'll be back in just 1 minute.
Thank you.
You're listening to Film Week on KPECC or via podcast. I'm Larry Mantle, so glad to have you with us. Let's get right back to John Horn's conversation with writer Jessica Bruder. She's the author of Nomadland, Surviving America in the 21st Century, which inspired the film out this week.
One of the things that's prominent in the film and in your book is a town that is essentially created by a gypsum company in Nevada. And it seems to represent so much of like the promise of post-war America and the perils of modern day. What is this city and what happened to it?
Yeah, so the city is Empire, Nevada, which was a gypsum mining town and a company town. And basically, I started reporting on Empire in 2011 because the town was shutting down. This was a factory village with 300 people right near the Black Rock Desert and one of the last remaining traditional company towns in America. The town was shutting down in the aftermath of the recession. People weren't buying the drywall that they made anymore because of the construction slump. So you had 300 people who lived in this place, and suddenly they were thrust out into the world. And to me, that was just such a potent image of the dispossessed that, you know, it stuck with me.
A movie is, by definition, about narrative and character. Your book is a lot about exposition and root causes. And exposition doesn't always work in a movie, and root causes are good literary devices, but they're not great cinema. So I want to talk about some of the things that your book brings up that I think are important context for the film, and maybe even more important than what we see in the movie. And that is, I'm going to read from it a little bit. In the widening gap between credits and debits hangs a question. What parts of this life are you willing to give up so you can keep on living? When do impossible choices start to tear people, a society, apart? It's almost existential, but it's really at the heart of your reporting. I want to hear a little bit more about that idea, about the choices people make to hang on, that this is not a life they want. They come to make the best of it, but no one is doing this for desire. They're doing it by necessity.
Yeah, and even that becomes murky in a complicated, interesting way when you talk to people, because whenever I met people, they would tell me they did this by choice. And then, you know, maybe 5 days later, I would hear about the medical debt, the house that was underwater, the random catastrophe, the losing money in the Great Recession, ageism in the workplace, you name it. And I think for a lot of people, they felt that, you know, maybe I could have crashed on my daughter's couch instead of being out here, but I made a choice and I didn't. Maybe I could have stayed in that flea bag motel with, you know, dealers down the hallway, but I didn't feel safe there, so I didn't. So for a lot of people I met, this was a form of agency, a limited one, but a form of agency. And largely, it had come into the world because rent prices and the prices of living in a traditional shelter overall have been going up and wages are flat. So you've got this unmovable object and you've got this unstoppable force, and these people are essentially caught in the middle.
Movies are cast with characters, usually fictional, and good reporting is cast with people, generally not fictional, depending on the reporter. You have Bob Wells, you have Swank, you have all of these characters. How did you develop a relationship with them where they were willing to expose, you know, their true situation to you? And how critical were they to your assembling the narrative of your book?
Oh, absolutely critical. Without access, you can't do anything. And I would hate to do a book that was only exposition. I'm not a polemicist. I feel most excited about writing the narrative components of a book like this. And gosh, Linda and I hit it off quite quickly. I think I asked if I could pet her dog. We were at the Rubber Tramp Rendezvous. For other people I met in the book, it took a little longer. I met one woman who told me when we first encountered each other that you're a journalist, you're going to make us out to be a bunch of homeless vagabonds. And then she kind of scowled at me and I ran away. Days later, I was still there. I was still there in my van. I hadn't left. And she was telling me her whole story. So part of it is hanging around long enough that you become part of the furniture. And people, you know, they vibe you out. And hopefully, if they're comfortable, they share their stories.
Frances McDormand tells a story about Fern, the character she plays, and how, in part, it's something that she kind of always wanted to do. There's part of her in that character. Having read the book, I would argue there's a lot of Jessica in that character as well. And I'm curious, did you have conversations with Frances McDormand about what you experienced that helped inform her character, or with Chloe Jaw, or was it all kind of at an arm's distance?
So there was one point when I was speaking with Chloe, and she told me that Frances' character, Fern, would essentially be a mix of three people. Both Frances, in that there's some degree of wish fulfillment in her wanting to get out on the road. Linda May, in that she's a person who is new to the road. And me, but not me as myself or me as a journalist, me as a through line. In a book like Nomadland, where you're meeting a lot of people, sometimes you need someone who's always going to be there, even if it's a very quiet presence, somebody who's a proxy for the reader. And in that way, I think Fern was a docent, as they like to say. Fern was essentially a tour guide. She is the backbone of the story and travels through it. But that journey exposes us to so many people with all these different backgrounds living in all these different ways, which is, to a large extent, what I tried to do in the book, and the only reason I showed up in it at all, which is, you know, usually not my preference, because I want to tell other people's stories.
In your book and in the film, there is this palpable sense of community, that these people are bound together by what has brought them to wherever they are living, be it a car, a pickup truck, a van, might be geography, it might be jobs, but they are kind of connected in an almost intangible way, but it's certainly, to the viewer, the reader, it's tangible to see that they are part of one kind of larger organism.
They're all outsiders to a certain degree. They're all people who feel like others might misunderstand who they are and what they're about a little bit. And I think they've all been brought together by adversity. George Orwell liked to write about how it often took great adversity to bring out some of the qualities we like best in the human character, whether it's creativity, resilience, care, courage, all of these things that only work in function to adversity. You also have this book by Rebecca Solnit, which I love, A Paradise Built in Hell, that talks about the micro-utopias that come in the wake of disaster. So essentially, I think what we're seeing here is a lot of that. It's, while we wouldn't wish adversity on anybody, the connections that these people forge are entirely powerful.
And even if we're not in the midst of a great recession, the gap between the haves and the have-nots, the concentration of wealth, is accelerating. How is that going to contribute to the housing and employment crisis that you focus on in your book?
Yeah, I mean, there's a certain point at which I think money works best when it's kinetic energy rather than when it's built up in kind of fat reserves. A lot of things that were already happening have been accelerated by the pandemic. I don't know how we're going to handle a coming eviction crisis with so many people out of work and so many landlords who are also trying to get by as mom and pop folks who are not giant corporations.
That's our John Horn talking with Jessica Bruder, the author of the book that inspired the new film Nomadland, starring Frances McDormand, written and directed by Chloe Zhao. You can see it in select theaters and on Hulu. It's Film Week on KPCC. Have a wonderful weekend.